Hi, hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, for new Catholics, those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Keith Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? That question rocked my world and led me on a deep dive into the history of Christianity, history of my faith, of the Bible, of the Reformation, of different kinds of movements of Christianity. And in the end, I began reading in depth from the Catholic Church, and for the very first time, from the Catholic Church in its own words, from actual Catholic authors and Catholic sources. And I realized then that what I thought I knew about Catholics and their faith, what they believed, what they did, was based in large part on misinformation, and more often than not, on simple misunderstandings. Well, this show aims to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think we believe as Catholics and what we actually do. No misinformation here. Each week I'm joined by real Catholic thinkers talking about topics from the heart of the Catholic Church. We try. And this week, I am joined by Dr. Mark Giesecheck, a scholar of sacred theology who has spent a lifetime plumbing the depths of those really difficult things of Christianity, the Catholic faith, of those dark passages in the Bible. And this week in particular, his new book on suffering, we mine what the Church says about suffering. How to understand suffering, how as Catholics we can, in opposition to or opposed to the atheism, those who don't believe, and even many evangelical, you know, Protestant Christians, how we as Catholics uniquely understand the point and the purpose, what's going on in suffering. It's a fantastic conversation, really, why we suffer and what to do about it. It's a really good time, and it was funny to say for a topic about suffering, conversation about suffering, but it really is. It's really digging into that meaty, kind of real, everyday bits of Catholicism and how the Church wrestles with those really fundamental questions and some great answers. It's a wonderful conversation. I hope you like it. I loved having it. Hopefully you love hearing it too. This conversation and others on this show are brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic and our one-time sponsors at paypal.me/cordialcatholic. Guys, you guys help to keep this show going and growing week after week, help it to reach new audiences, pay for all the things that costs of this show. So thank you for your support. If you feel led to help support this show, those links are in the show notes as well. And thank you, everyone, whoever you are, for listening. And now, without any further ado, my fantastic conversation, why we suffer and what to do about it, with Dr. Mark Giesecheck. It's fantastic. Hopefully you enjoy it. Please listen and do enjoy. Hey friends, welcome back to the show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. If you're listening on podcast, on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please leave a rating or review. That helps to push the podcast out to new listeners and expand the reach of these kinds of conversations. And thank you for listening. If you are watching on YouTube, thank you. Please subscribe to our growing channel. Like the video, hit the thumbs up, hit the bell for notifications for each and every new video each and every week when they come out. And thank you for watching. Guys, this week, a fantastic conversation. Not like a super fun topic, but a topic that I love to dig into. It's so important, and I'm really excited for this conversation, although that's kind of strange to say, I think. I'm joined by Dr. Mark Giesecheck. He is professor of Sacred Scripture at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology, the author of some fantastic books, including Suffering, What Every Catholic Should Know, in that amazing series out from the Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press, amongst other fantastic books. Dr. Giesecheck, I want to say welcome back to the show. You were here episode 91 back in 2021. So welcome. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Happy to have you. We had a great time last time. It was ages ago. You probably have forgotten that, but I loved you as a guest, and I wanted to have you back talking about your book, your Dark Passages book, because I heard you on, I think it was Classical Theism with John DeRosa. I think that's where I heard you, a good mutual friend of ours. And I thought, this is a great, fantastic topic. It's one of those big topics that every atheist and his uncle used to be a Christian and left the faith because of suffering, because of these dark passages of scripture, these awful things they can't reconcile, they encounter. And it seems like this is the area, and you obviously know this, I get tons of emails and comments on every video that I post and notes, and know lots of people who have left the faith or wrestle with the faith or can't figure out why they should still believe in the God of Christianity, the God of the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith, when there is so much evil and suffering. So you wrote a great book on this, on dark passages, and I think I know why you're tapped to write this book on suffering in this Every Catholic Should Know series, because it is one of those great big things that I think everybody wrestles with, and so many people hit this roadblock and are unprepared, or something has gone wrong, and they just quit. They have been quit so many times because of this big thing. Is the perennial question that you have solved for us now. Haven't you? I want to know, first of all, why? So why is this an area of interest for you? And maybe how did that come to be? Because it fascinates me. I do love this topic, how, as dark as that sounds. Where does your love for suffering come from, Dr. Giese?
Well, I don't know if any of us love suffering. In fact, in the book, I quote a monk named Dom Hubert van Zeller. Yeah. And he says, if we didn't hate it, then it wouldn't be suffering. Right. So, so I think loving suffering is kind of a weird idea, but it's true. Yeah. Some of the saints use that language. And I think a lot of the issues you brought up are the things that drew me to this topic. I mean, obviously, every single one of us experiences suffering in various ways at different times in our lives. And of course, that's caused me to reflect. But there's no like one key dramatic moment that I can think of that led to me writing this book. I do think that it presents a challenge to faith, right? Yeah. The reality of suffering is a great challenge. And one of the ways it's been put, this is Peter Kreef's paraphrase of St. Augustine. I think he says something like, if God is all good and all loving, right, then why does he let bad things happen to good people? Yeah. Right? And we could phrase that a million different ways, right? Why do children get cancer is maybe an easy way to phrase it. And it's a conundrum, right? There's no like easy out. There's no easy explanation. There's no perfect solution. And I think this insight actually gets at something you were bringing up, is that when people start to think about the suffering they've experienced and this kind of dissonance between their own experience and what they have heard taught about God and his goodness and his mercy, there seems to be a kind of irreconcilability, right? Where it's like, there's no way that a good and all-powerful God could coexist with the suffering that I'm experiencing right now. It doesn't make sense. God, why don't you take this away? And I think we can kind of like back ourselves into an intellectual corner there and get kind of stuck in that frame of mind. It just becomes like almost like a broken record. Like there's this problem. I don't have a solution. I need a solution. I'm thinking about it. I can't solve it. So I'm just going to give up and walk away. But the problem is, if you give up and walk away and say, shake your fist at the heavens and say, God, I'm not going to believe in you anymore because this bad thing happened to me, the problem actually continues to chase you, right? Yeah. Like if you say, no, I'm not going to pick up my cross and follow Jesus, well, the cross has a way of finding you anyway, right? It's like suffering has a way of kind of like hunting you down and saying, no, you're going to have to deal with me one way or the other. And I think it was this realization that really drew me to think about the topic and how it doesn't really go away if you become an atheist, right? It doesn't really go away if you become a Christian, right? Suffering is still with us, right? People still get sick. People still die. There are still all kinds of terrible things that happen in our lives. And we have to have a way of thinking about them in order to reconcile that kind of cognitive dissonance we experience. And I feel like the way that a lot of books treat the topic is overly abstract and philosophical, right? Where it's about kind of like thinking our way to the end of the philosophical puzzle of suffering. And I really didn't want to write a book like that. I wanted to get something that was a little bit more hands-on, a little bit more down to earth and applicable, that thought through that question, sure, but also thought about Jesus's suffering and how we participate in that. And well, what about fasting? Or, you know, what about if I lose someone that I love? Or what about sickness? And I really wanted to kind of look at it from a lot of different angles to think about how we can achieve, spiritual growth, right? Growth in virtue through the midst of suffering, growth in joy through the midst of suffering. And I feel like a lot of the books didn't treat it the way that I needed it to be treated. So, right, so you know, I think it's like one of those things where, you know, the book I wanted to read wasn't out there, so I felt like I had to write it. So that was my goal, you know, is to just kind of demystify the problem of suffering and actually give people some practical strategies for tackling it, dealing with it in their daily lives.
Yeah, yeah. I love one thing you said there, first of all, in this little section here, is the idea that, and I think this is so important to underscore, and this is the kind of thing that I often go for when I'm trying to dialogue with people who have maybe left the Christian faith, left the Catholic faith because of suffering, is that, like you say, this faith, the Catholic faith, gives us a framework for suffering. Right? We're going to suffer as an atheist. We're going to suffer as agnostic. You're going to suffer wherever you go if you leave the Catholic faith. But gee whiz, doesn't the Catholic faith give maybe the best framework for suffering, the best explanation, the best kind of remedies or reasons why? And I think that to me is very compelling to present, to say, look, okay, you are still suffering. As an atheist, you've left the Catholic faith because you think God wouldn't allow suffering and he's evil to let you suffer. Well, you're still suffering. So why not consider this framework maybe a new or more wholesome way or check this out, right? Because I think it provides a really compelling framework in which to suffer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you kind of walk down the atheist way of thinking a while and you start to wonder, okay, so how do they start to make sense of these things? And, you know, most atheists are materialist, right? So they really believe that we don't really have a soul. It's like our thinking capacities, our sentience just sort of arises from the body. And it seems like we have an invisible soul, but in fact, we just have a body that happens to be very, you know, advanced in terms of evolution. So that means then that the evils that we experience in life are totally explicable in physical terms, right? So it's just like, well, a rock hit me on the toe. That's why my toe hurts. Or my DNA did this, and that's why I have this problem or whatever. And what you end up with, I think, in that framework is a universe that ultimately doesn't make sense.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think is deeply unsatisfying at a kind of intellectual and spiritual level. It's not because they're wrong in all of their explanations, right? We do live in a physical world and physical things affect us. If a tornado comes and flattens your house, you're going to suffer, right? So there are plenty of ways in which their thinking is on the right track. But where they get on the wrong track is thinking that the human soul is really just a product of the universe, right? That it really just kind of arises from rocks and primordial ooze or whatever. And that actually at the depth of us is not satisfying. We actually need something deeper than that. We need something more than that. Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the challenges of faith, right, is dealing with these types of questions, right? That while believing in God and believing he has a plan for my life, believing he created me and believing that he wants to welcome me into eternity, it sets up a framework, like you said, for thinking about all of my sufferings and my whole life story. A framework that makes sense, right? That I did not create myself, that I didn't arise from things lower than myself, but in fact, a far greater intelligence than me created me and the world that I live in and wants to be with me for all eternity. And I think it's the beauty and the romance of the Christian story that is one of those things I think an atheist kind of looks at that and is like, wow, that's too good to be true, right? I could never believe that. In fact, I'd prefer to just live in my state of unbelief because it seems more rational, even though it's more hopeless.
Yeah.
And so I there's something about the gospel that challenges like the poet in each one of us, right? That it's like, we have to reach out and touch that thing and be like, wow, I can't see God. I can't be 100% scientifically sure that he exists. And yet I exist. And my own existence is like a clue to the nature of the universe, right? The fact that I exist and that I know myself, that I can think about my own life, past, present, and future, makes me think, you know what? There must be an intelligence that is greater than me. And it's only in the context of that story, right, that I think suffering begins to make sense, right? That suffering, I mean, we talk about, say, animal suffering, or some people even think of plants as suffering, right? But there's a way in which those types of suffering, even though I think we can witness it in animals very clearly, it's of a lower order than human suffering, right? Human suffering is at a greater depth. And yeah, I think that in our experiences of suffering, sometimes we actually come face to face with ourselves in a deeper and more profound way than in the rest of the experience of life. And it's in those moments, I think, that our faith is challenged, right? That we're tested. And that, you know, sometimes we actually feel closer to God in the depth of those moments of greatest suffering.
Yeah. A small aside, I love, you mentioned that you wrote the book you wanted to read. And I think I love how you did format this book. Like the chapters aren't easy. Like, why you suffer here? Why, how to fix that? The end, right? You have a chapter called Suffering Tests Us, right? Suffering disorients us. I like how I can't just pick this book up and go, okay, here's the answer right here. Right? You make us work, but you meet us in these places. And I think that's great. So kudos to you for that. It's a very well-written book. It unfolds very nicely. And it's very well done. But you're right about suffering testing us. One of these ideas. We see clearly in Scripture that this happens. There are moments when God, I don't know, this is a philosophical, but causes suffering or allows suffering to happen, right? And we see the purpose of this. We can see in hindsight the whole story there in Scripture. It was to test that person, right? We often know in our own lives, the lives of the saints, right? This happens. God allows suffering or creates suffering. Again, you can pick up these threads here that I'm just going to unspool for us. But the suffering, it tests us. It's for a reason. And like you say, to often those times, the reason, the purpose can be understood to draw us closer to God in those times, right? Let's unpack that a bit, the idea of that testing and that, I don't know, allowing versus causing. How do we orient ourselves to that when those tests happen? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, maybe one of the most dramatic examples is when God tests Abraham, right?
Yeah,
and he calls him to sacrifice his only son, Isaac, who he had waited for. Isaac was the child of promise, and he had been promised to Abraham, and finally, after many, many years, Abraham finally has a son, and now God says, you know, take him up the mountain and kill him. And it's one of those, like, deeply mysterious passages in the Bible that you kind of think about over and over again in life, and, like, the more you age, the more complex your thoughts become about that passage, right? Because as a boy, you think, wow, I hope my dad wouldn't listen to God if he said that, right? And then as a father, you think, wow, what about my children, you know? And there's a lesson embedded in that story, right? So does God cause Abraham suffering? Well, sort of, right? God blesses Abraham, and then he basically asks him, are you willing to give up all of the blessings that I've given to you?
Yeah.
Right? Are you, out of obedience to me, out of love for me, are you willing to just let go of all of the things that you have? It's very similar, actually, to the test of Job, right, who loses 10 children and all of his animals and property and so forth. And I think this is one of the, like, weird challenges of, like, learning how to live human life well, right, is that nothing's permanent. Everything's always changing. Everything's always in flux. And at the end, you have to give up all, right? You have to give up all your friends and relatives and all of your possessions and so forth in order to go and be with God. And so why does God test Abraham this way? And how does that map onto our suffering? I mean, I think God is trying to teach Abraham the deepest spiritual lesson of all, right? Which is the lesson of love, right? Am I willing to actually give up all of the things that I cling to and go out of myself in love for God? Am I willing to give up everything for him and follow him and love him? And, you know, it's similar to the kinds of tests that we hear in these, like, stories of heroism, right? Where, you know, somebody goes into a burning building to rescue a child, or, you know, jumps into a freezing cold river to rescue someone. And where, you know, you take a significant risk upon yourself and maybe even die for the sake of another.
Yeah.
And it's really in that moment that we see your true humanity, right? Your true virtue, where it's like, wow, that person is a hero because they were willing to give up everything for the sake of this other person. And I think that that's what is being called forth in Abraham. And it's really only in the moments of testing that we learn who we really are, right? If we're never tested, we don't even know whether we have those virtues.
Yeah.
And so I think God allows us to be tested in our life, whether it's by temptation, by suffering, by various types of trials and difficulties, in order that we might grow in virtue and really learn to be like him, right? To really actually grow in holiness, to grow to be like Christ.
Yeah. There are times when there's a distinction, I guess, in suffering. There's sufferings that are naturally mentioned. You mentioned tornadoes, earthquakes, these things, sicknesses, illnesses in people, in infants and in children. I mean, these things are really hard to understand. And then there's also a kind of suffering that, you know, I can cause to somebody else, or someone else can cause to me, right? I can hurt somebody physically, emotionally, and they can hurt me back. I can steal somebody's things and they suffer the loss of those things, for example. Those are distinctions in suffering. Now, one, I think it's easy to see. If I steal someone's things, they are deprived of those goods. I am doing a wrong thing. I can understand that. I'm causing that suffering. But there's that suffering then, that those natural things, right? The hurricanes, tornadoes, the sicknesses of people that seem kind of uncaused by other people, they just happen. And that's one of those big questions. Well, why would God let those kind of things happen? Is that evil in the same way that me stealing someone's things is evil? Like, how do we distinguish between those things and understand those kinds of sufferings? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So one way of dividing it up, right, is that there are sufferings that are somebody's fault. That's what we call moral evil. And then there are sufferings that are nobody's fault, like tornadoes or earthquakes, like you mentioned. And ultimately, the explanation is the same, right? Is that we live in a fallen world, and that that world operates according to certain rules, and that those rules, like the laws of physics or gravity or whatever else, have consequences. And I think this is one of the places in which the atheist thinks he's made an escape, but actually hasn't. And what I mean by that is, if you say, well, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in a creator, I don't believe in an order, it's all just kind of random. The moral consequences of that are hedonistic, right? Essentially, I can do whatever I want because it doesn't matter. And what Christianity, and I think most religions, would challenge the atheist and say, oh, no. Actually, the things that you do matter very much. They matter a lot. To all of the people around you, to yourself and to
right.
God.
Yeah, yeah.
And that we have this kind of responsibility to avoid sin, right? And to do good, to do all the good that we can in the time that we're given. Okay, so that's maybe a kind of looking at the moral side, but then, okay, what do we do about the tornadoes and the earthquakes? How can we think about those in a way that makes sense, right? And it's something like this, right? That God created an ordered world, right? So, we know that from studying science, right? Think about the petals on a flower, or something like a pine cone, or the rings on a tree, or the structure of a cell, or the structure of an atom. We understand that the world that we live in has a structure that God has given to it. And that structure is good, okay? But God does not interfere in the world that we live in, at least not very often. Why doesn't he interfere? Because then our actions would not have consequences. We would end up living in an absurd world, right? Where, you know, you throw a baby out the window and an angel shows up and catches it and tosses it back to you, right? Or, you know, someone's about to shoot you or something and their gun turns into a squirt gun and they just shoot you with water, right? It would be a kind of like madcap world. I'm thinking of Bruce Almighty, you know, it's like, it would be crazy. It wouldn't make any sense because our actions wouldn't have consequences. Sin wouldn't exist, right? Righteousness wouldn't exist. We couldn't sin, not really. And we couldn't do good, not really. We would live in a sort of absurd world. Right, so God doesn't place us in an absurd world. God places us in an ordered world, an orderly world. And in the world that he's placed us, we have responsibility. Our actions have consequences. And yes, things like tornadoes exist because this world that we live in operates according to certain physical laws, which involve things like air pressure and clouds and so forth. So I don't know if it's necessarily a very satisfying explanation. All right, it would be nice if God would just take away all of the bad stuff. But I do think it's the right one.
Yeah. I'm trying to think this through for a second. And I guess, because of course God could stop that tornado that's coming, could stop the hurricane that's coming, could stop all these different things. But you're right, that becomes then a world that's missing that kind of choice. I mean, and if every, I don't know, what about if every hurricane that came just didn't come? Like, what would that world look like? Right? Or I guess wouldn't exist, or was stopped halfway to land. I mean, I see that. I wonder if the atheist could argue back then, well, what if God is kind of minimizes that, right? Lets the hurricane go a certain distance and then miraculously it stops. Is there a need for the gratuitous suffering of like natural disaster? Does that make sense?
Okay, so this is where I think we have an agreement with the atheists and a disagreement. Okay, so the agreement is we both believe life is good, right? Whether we're Christians or atheists, and I think most human beings believe life is good, except for a few very, very depressed people, okay? but where we disagree is the atheist thinks that life, human life on earth, is the ultimate end-all be-all, and particularly life without suffering, right? Whereas as a Christian, as a Catholic, I can say life on earth is good. God created it. It's good. But life in heaven with him forever is actually the eventual goal. And so death is not really the end of the story. It's only a beginning in a certain way. And so if a person dies in a natural disaster, we have sympathy and we care and we grieve and, you know, Catholic social services will show up, but we don't actually think that that's the end, right? We don't grieve in the same way that an atheist would grieve. And so I feel like that becomes a kind of, it's like a fulcrum for the argument, right? Thinking about, okay, so yes, it's true that some people might die before their time in a typhoon or something, but maybe that was their time. Maybe that was the time that the Lord had appointed for all eternity. Maybe that was the moment at which they were supposed to be welcomed into eternity. And maybe we shouldn't shake our heads at that in disbelief, but instead be like, wow, like this was the moment that they were called to be with God.
So that speaks to suffering of, say, the children, or people who die before they reach old age or something, right? That argument would then be that, okay, so you guys here, you atheists here, people who don't believe in an afterlife, you're seeing this life cut short, but you're seeing this side of things, where we as Catholics believe that God exists and sees the full spectrum of this, and that, right, your life might end short on this side of eternity, but actually that's not the end of your life. There is eternity over here that we can't see and that you atheists don't believe in, right? So I do see that that's a very different picture on suffering and a very different picture on that kind of natural suffering, right? It's hard to understand as an atheist why this child would be born and live for a few months and get sick and die. That's a horrible thing for everybody, believer, non-believer. It's a hopeless thing for the atheist, I would argue, but that's because they're not seeing the whole picture of this, right? I guess it comes down to the idea of God is not going to, if God is a good God, and I guess this opens up a whole other can of worms we can explore too, I think. If God is a good God, he is not going to give you a tiny little life here and then just cut it off and that not be an evil act, if it's not balanced out by, well, there's good reasons why this person here should enter eternity here and live with God forever, right? In an ultimate happiness, right? There is that kind of, right, what the atheist might see as an evil act because that child lived for a few months isn't actually an evil act because God is now embracing that child for eternity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are other kind of mitigating factors that might be helpful to think about too, right? That when we see people suffer from diseases, this actually evokes in us compassion for them, which in its early stages might mean that we're helping or nursing the sick. But in its later, more developed stages might mean we're developing new medicines and medical technologies to treat the sick so that fewer people need to experience that suffering, right? So there's a kind of human give and take in this experience that I think that, you know, the more we see children, you know, die of something like whooping cough or whatever, the more we're motivated to develop a vaccine or a medicine to help them. And so alleviating suffering, I think, is a very important human goal. But again, where we have this disagreement with the atheists is that they view alleviating suffering as kind of the end all be all. We don't. Yeah. Right, we think of suffering as actually part of life, not as something that you can be somehow exempt from, right? It's just like suffering is actually part of what it means to be human. And, you know, we look up into heaven and say, Lord, take my sufferings away, right? And instead of doing that, he comes down here and suffers with us, right? Which is kind of surprising. Like, oh, I didn't really expect you were going to do that, right? Why are you carrying that cross, Lord? Oh, come and carry it with me, right? And so Jesus teaches us something about suffering that was hard for us to learn through philosophical musing alone. I think in thinking about the atheist beliefs about this, the kind of most disturbing elements of this are these groups of atheists that want to bring an end to suffering by bringing an end to all life. You know, I think they call themselves something like the negative utilitarians or something. It's like really terrifying to think that there are people who are motivated in that way, right? They just think, well, life is full of suffering. No one should have children. We should bring an end to all life. And it's like, that's not a Catholic frame of mind, right? Yeah. We see a value and a good, and I think often a growth in virtue and in spirituality as we learn how to endure suffering. That doesn't mean suffering itself is good. So one of the points I make early in the book is John Paul II, in his letter on suffering, Salvifici Dolores, defines it as suffering in itself is an experience of evil. And it's really important to keep that in mind, right? That suffering is an experience of evil. It's how we respond to it that can be good or virtuous or transformative and this kind of thing, right? Where the Lord can give us the grace to respond to suffering with joy and perseverance and endurance. And it's those virtues that are good, right? But the experience itself is an experience of evil.
Yeah. Which I think is that is so important, right? To acknowledge that, that this is an evil thing that's happening to you. And we don't always have the answer about why that's happening, right? I think it's safe to say that, you know, God is in control. God knows why you're suffering. He's using it for a purpose, right? We can see in the scriptures, in the Gospels, in the Old Testament, these in the stories of saints, right? These people who have suffered have gone through and come out the other side. And we can see the trajectory of their story and their lives. And we have our own sufferings, and sufferings of those that we know that we can see kind of sometimes in hindsight the result of how that unfolded and the virtues, the good things that came out at the end. But I'm thinking, like, you know, alongside somebody who is suffering, there's not always going to be that easy answer. Well, here's why you're suffering, or here's why you're suffering, right? But we can know, can we know in the least to say, hey, you know what, you are suffering, but you know, God will use this for something good, something better than to even this out, like the experience of this suffering here will be rewarded is the wrong word, but, you know, made right. I'm thinking of the story of Job, right? Job did all the suffering. Well, Job was then at the end of Job, he's given, you know, I think tenfold more than he had to begin with, right? So it was made right and much more. Is it safe to say that our experience of suffering will be that even if we can't explain it away for somebody, and we shouldn't, I don't think, try to, one of the comforts we can bring a person who's suffering is that God will, you know, redeem this and that much more. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, this is where I think we need to be kind of cautious, maybe, in the way that we talk to somebody who's in the midst of suffering. And I quote some of the typical lines in the book, you know, like, offer it up, or, you know, God wouldn't give this to you unless you were able to handle it, you know, that kind of thing. And I think we need to be cautious about advising people who are suffering. I think often what people need is a hug and some compassion and a listening ear and, you know, maybe not a whole lot of advice. But when it comes back to, when it comes to the point of thinking through the problem with, whether it be with ourselves or with somebody who is suffering, I actually think the best framework for working our way through it is the framework of grief. So in the chapter on Job, I kind of compare Job's experience with the five stages of grief. And, you know, the final stage in grief is acceptance. And it's just such a, it's such an important place to get to, right? And I feel like one way to kind of focus your mind on that trajectory is by just meditating on your own death, which the saints have recommended for ages. And what does it do, right? It kind of puts everything in perspective. You're like, well, if my life is going to come to an end, right? There is, we all have an expiration date, you know? And thinking about that really helps to focus your energy. That, you know, it's not necessarily about accumulating a lot of stuff or doing exciting trips or something like this, right? Life has a deeper meaning, you know, that has to do with love, with prayer, with devotion, with giving of yourself, with handing it on to the next generation, you know, that kind of thing. And I think when we meditate on our own death, we can get to that place of acceptance where we really deeply down accept our mortality. And then it's like, once we get there, it's like everything else, every other suffering is somehow secondary, right? Because we know that there's a kind of time limit on the suffering. And so I guess, you know, thinking in terms of spiritual advice, right? Getting to a place of accepting my own mortality will really help, you know, say for example, when you get a terminal cancer diagnosis, right? Or some other really bad news, you know, you just realize, you know, this is a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I'm reconciled to the fact that there's going to be an end to this story. And I'm not going to indulge this kind of unrealistic script. So early in the book, I talk about how oftentimes we have like this script in our minds, right? Where like, you know, everything I do is always going to succeed and everyone's always going to like me and I'm going to live to be 100 and so will all of my friends and relatives and no one's ever going to get sick. Nothing bad will ever happen. My car will never break down. I'll always have more than enough, you know, and but we know that that's actually unrealistic, you know. Yeah. and that life is full of, you know, challenges, difficulties, shortages, you know, bills, whatever. And that, and we shouldn't, be angry, I don't think, when our unrealistic script begins to break down, right? And we start to experience sufferings that we didn't anticipate or didn't want or didn't accept. But I think by beginning at the end with the problem of death and coming to accept that, it's easier then to kind of rewind the present and be like, okay, I can handle this, right? I can get from here to there.
Yeah, yeah. One of the, I think acceptance, maybe a synonym for the word docile, being docile to what's going on, the will of God, right? And it's something that I have really come to embrace and love in the last many years, right? The idea of just being docile to whatever God brings my way, right? That kind of abandonment to divine providence kind of idea, right? Just whatever happens, you know, God is in control. Is that the same thing as acceptance? Because to me, this kind of seems like a way to get through suffering, just to go, you know what? And this maybe is an hourly thing sometimes, we're actually going through a period of suffering, to keep saying, you know what? Okay, I accept this. I'll let this go. I'm just going to be a feather in the breeze of this awful suffering that's happening and try and trust God. Is that kind of a similar concept there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think acceptance comes from the language of like grief counseling and psychology.
Yeah.
And the language of surrender, of course, comes from our spiritual tradition. And Abandonment to Divine Providence is a helpful book in that regard. So maybe I'll say two things about this. Okay. So first is when we suffer, I think, that test that we talked about, right? It's really when we get to this kind of fork in the road. Okay. And down one path, which I call the false road of comfort, right, is all sorts of things that we do to try to make our life easier, right? So, you know, think of somebody like sitting on a comfy couch with lots of pillows in their pajamas, you know, binge watching Netflix and eating popcorn and ice cream, yeah, right?
That's nice.
That's the false road of comfort, yeah. Okay? And I think oftentimes, you know, when we get to a very, very difficult place in life, we find ourselves kind of headed that direction, right? The other path, though, the other fork, right, is the true road, which is the true road of acceptance, okay? Where instead of living in this place of like denial or of comfort seeking, I'm actually like looking my suffering in the face. I'm picking up the cross with Jesus and I'm walking up Mount Calvary with him. And that's where we need to get to. So, I mean, I think we kind of flip back and forth between the false road of comfort and the true road of acceptance. And in the Old Testament, you know, it's the path of the fool and the path of the wise. But we can't stay in that realm of comfort seeking, you know, because what does it lead to, right? It's going to lead to things like depression and isolation and maybe diabetes and whatever else, right? Where like if the more we seek comfort, the more we realize that actually doesn't work, right? So, you know, you can eat a bowl of ice cream and maybe feel better for a few minutes, right? But if you keep eating bowls of ice cream, eventually you're going to get sick or, you know, you have all sorts of problems. And it's not going to actually solve the real suffering that you're experiencing. Whereas if you go the other way and you embrace virtue and discipline and the gifts of the Holy Spirit and the power of God and the power of the gospel and the power of faith and hope to transform your life, wow, then things begin to change, right? Where you can actually be in the midst of your suffering at the exact same time you're experiencing joy. And that's really the Christian mystery, right? Where you see these saints who are suffering so much, maybe suffering martyrdom or you know, suffering in the midst of extreme poverty like Mother Teresa, and they've got a big smile on their face. And it's so confusing to the world out there, like, what is going on, right? Well, they're experiencing suffering, but they've learned the secret of experiencing joy at the same time as they're experiencing suffering. So it's those two paths, right? The false road of comfort, the true road of acceptance. And we really want to walk that true road. But I want to work our way back to spiritual surrender, right? So this idea of abandonment to divine providence, or you've probably heard the surrender novena, right? And I think that these are really helpful spiritual practices that we need to adopt. But I think we also need to be a little bit cautious. And what I mean is, if we were to take those spiritual practices completely literally, right, it would be very easy for us to adopt an almost apathetic mindset toward our own life, right? Like, oh, I'm not going to put any effort toward anything. I'm not going to try to build anything. I'm just going to let life happen to me. And we don't want to stay in that frame of mind, right? So I think sometimes when we're experiencing suffering, we need to get ourselves into that kind of spiritually passive frame of mind, you know, and be like, whatever happens is the will of God, and I'm going to accept it. But I do think other times God calls people to actively do projects, right? To build businesses or ministries or to write books, for example, or to do other things that really cause, you know, that really call for creativity and, you know, spontaneity and that kind of like approach to life that I think of as very masculine. Like, I'm going to build something, you know? So I feel like there's a little bit of tension in my mind over how far we can take that kind of surrender idea before we kind of take it too far.
No, that makes perfect sense. I think of the idea that that kind of joy in suffering, I had the awful experience of leading a group of new Catholics through the RCIA process several different times. One of those times, we got to the end, it was a very joyful time, and the priest, the pastor of our parish, was like laicized the next week. And it was like a shock. It was an absolute like spiritual shock to all of us. I mean, we were close, myself and this priest. These candidates had just like the week before been accepted into the church and had this profound, beautiful, mysterious thing happen. And you know, the next week they find out, well, this priest was doing things that were inappropriate on the side and was removed and was, you know, removed from the clergy and eventually had to trial these things and then laicized. It was a very dark time for all of us, but they were just brand new Catholics. So there was a joy in there, and talk about like a weird juxtaposition. I mean, for all of us, but especially for these new Catholics, to have this period of deep suffering that they hadn't done to themselves, right? Again, one of these kind of things that happens from the outside. It wasn't as if they did anything to cause themselves the suffering. It happened to them in this joyful period of time as a brand new Catholic. Very, very disorienting. But that's me when you say it's kind of joy in suffering. Well, here's this example of finding, okay, the beauty of the Catholic Church, the comfort of the Eucharist and the sacraments, you have access to as a Catholic. Well, and by the way, you need them, because here's this massive suffering that's just kind of plopped down on your plate. But I think of that. I think also that testing idea, right? What was it that these new Catholics needed, that God knew they needed? And here's the kind of awful seeming way he delivered to them. But you got to think that's also a major faith strengthening thing to right away experience this kind of awful suffering. Like, I don't know if you can make sense of that. I'm still wrestling through that, obviously, all these years later. But that's just a crazy position of that joy in suffering situation, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think the scandals of the past 20 years have really affected all of us. I mean, I'm thinking back on my own childhood, and the priest that I received my first confession and first communion from was an abuser. and was laicized a couple years later. So I had that same experience myself.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it reminds me of the parable of the weeds and the wheat, right? That, you know, that it's not until the end times when the angels are bringing in the harvest that the weeds and the wheat will be separated. And right now, you know, we live in this drama of sin and grace and judgment and mercy. And, you know, each one of us, right, our actions have consequences, and the Lord will bring us into judgment. And if we are repentant, the Lord will have mercy on us. And I mean, I think that the simultaneity of sin and grace is always kind of really hard to deal with, right? Or surprising or challenging, right? Where we live in a fallen world, and we live, you know, in the city of God and the city of man, and the dividing line between those two cities goes right through our hearts, right? And you know, I think that's a perpetual challenge for us to deal with, confront, think about, and wrestle with. But wow, I'm really sorry that you had that experience.
I guess that's the flip side too of suffering, is that justice part of it, right? Like, if there's that, and again, I think for me, this is kind of compelling, again, to that atheist perspective, that, okay, there is suffering, we can kind of explain it, and we can explain as Christians also the justice, that need, that feeling that we have in our cores for justice to take place here, right? Of course, grace and mercy throw a wrench into that, a good wrench, you could argue, right? But there's a compelling case for that other side, that justice in the face of evil, right? In the Catholic narrative.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, I'm an Old Testament scholar. And so I think that might be why I think about these topics and these tensions a little bit more. Where in the Old Testament, you know, we see God's justice enacted in really dramatic ways in multiple occasions. Yeah. And I think that can be really startling for us. And, you know, that's part of the reason I wrote that other book, Light on the Dark Passages. But I think what you're alluding to is this kind of satisfaction in divine judgment that we feel. You know, and there's a scene in the Book of Wisdom where we're sort of at the divine judgment, and there's a righteous man there who had been persecuted by the wicked, and the wicked are standing before the throne of God and are worried about the accusations that he'll make against them. And they realize how wrong they were, you know? And it's like, if we don't have the justice of God, right? If God is just a lenient God, not a just God, then we never get the righting of wrongs, right? We never get the kind of evening of the score. Things don't work out in the end if there's no justice in God. And so the justice of God is necessary to make the entire world make sense, right? Without the justice of God, we can't comprehend, you know, the horrors of the Holocaust. We can't comprehend, you know, the horrors of abuse and so forth, right? But we really believe that God will hold people to account for their actions in this life. And holding on to that belief, I think, is about holding on to hope.
Yeah, because you talk to people who suffer through things like, you know, genocides, things like violent deaths, right? Or scandals, or things that are clearly wrong. You feel it in your core. And there is that kind of drive for, well, this has to be made right somehow, right? And of course, that kind of like blood justice, like vigilantism, like that desire for vengeance is not the appropriate kind of, but that's maybe a shade of justice, right? That's maybe like in there somewhere, but not the end of justice, right? But, and of course, there's mercy, right? Which is confusing. Like, you know, the parables that feature mercy in the scriptures are the hardest to understand for us, right? Like we want that son who squandered his inheritance and ran away to, like, okay, well, he was rude. He made poor choices. Like, he should pay something of that, right? And that mercy kind of disorients us, right? But there is that, like, that inbuilt that, again, I don't think that other framers can explain very well. Why do we feel a need for justice, right? And how unsatisfying is it that those evils, those wrongs, just kind of hang out there, right, and never get resolved in some kind of sense, right? That doesn't sit right with us, you know, at our core, I think, right? So I think that's another thing that is so compelling for this the Catholic narrative, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it helps us make sense of the cross, right? That it's at the cross that our injustices against a just God are paid for, if you will, right? And redeemed, right? They're turned from, you know, rather than us being cut off from God, we're restored to unity with God by the blood of Christ. But it's the awesome price of the cross that brings that about. You know, it's not a cheap grace, so to speak. And this is where, you know, there's this word that New Testament scholar Michael Gorman likes to use, which is cruciformity, right? That St. Paul, who he studies, is the cross-shaped, right, cruciform apostle. And this is what we're all called to be. Right, is cruciform. We're all supposed to be conformed to the shape of the cross. When we look at the crucifix, we shouldn't just see Jesus there, we should see ourselves there in some sense, right? That Jesus has called us to participate in his sacrifice by our very own sacrifices, by our very own sufferings, offering them up in a kind of spiritual surrender and a spiritual union with him. And it's through this that our sufferings can be redeemed, and that we can find this kind of satisfaction in them. This is something that I think is really mysterious, right? It's kind of, it's almost like hyper-spiritual or something, but I feel like it's really important. And one way to see it is, I talked about Mother Teresa, and Mother Teresa set up a group of what she called sick and suffering co-workers of the Missionaries of Charity. So these were people who had terminal illnesses or chronic pain, and this kind of thing. And they could sign up to offer their suffering for the work of the Missionaries of Charity on a lifelong basis. So these people would be at home or in their hospital beds, right, in great pain and suffering for years and years and years. And they would be offering all of that as a spiritual sacrifice for the work of the missionaries. And it is kind of hyper-spiritual. It's kind of weird, right? Like, how does that even work, you know, in the kind of mystery of divine providence? You know, we don't really have a lot of super great theological answers for how all those dots connect, but we know that they do, right? We know that somehow they connect and that matters, right? That the suffering of those people matters. This might be a kind of silly example, but, you know, when people run a marathon, oftentimes they gather donations, you know, pledges from their friends, you know, for a cause that they believe in, you know? So, you know, people pledge $50, $100 or whatever for, you know, save the whales or whatever cause it might be. And, you know, as they are preparing training for their marathon and then running the marathon, which involves a lot of pain and suffering and difficulty, they constantly have in mind, I'm doing this for the sake of this cause, right? For these people, for this cause. And I think that motivates a marathon runner. And I feel like life is kind of the same way, right? We're all running a kind of marathon, and all of our sufferings can be offered up for the good of others.
Yeah. You talk about positive on purpose suffering too in this book, right? And that's, the marathon is an example of that. Almsgiving, you know, fasting, these things you can do to actually, you know, cause your own suffering. How does it's fascinating, right? These ideas of offering up your suffering, giving your suffering. It's touched on in scripture, the idea of, you know, making up what's lacking in the cross. Like that's one of those mysterious passages of the Bible. Like, wait a minute, what's lacking in Christ's suffering, and how can we do anything to meet that? Are those things in the same vein, like offering up our sufferings, somehow mysteriously connecting Christ on the, how do we make sense of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the practices, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving are sufferings that we choose on purpose that actually prepare us for the sufferings that we don't choose on purpose.
Okay, okay.
Right, so the more that we're fasting, the more prepared we are to, say, skip a meal if we have to, right? The more we're giving alms, the more we're able to part with our money when it needs to happen. And prayer, you might not think of it as a form of suffering, but when we pray, right, we give up time for God, right? We could be scrolling on our phones, you know, looking at Facebook or whatever, and instead we're giving that time to the Lord, you know, in prayer. There's also an ancient tradition of vigil keeping, right, where we stay up late at night to pray, giving up sleep for God. So when we give up these things on purpose, right, we choose these little sufferings, they actually form us and mold us and shape us and help us to cope with the big sufferings that we can't predict or anticipate, the ones that just arrive in life. And I think the more we neglect suffering on purpose, the harder it is actually to deal with the sufferings that come our way. So I like to think of those practices as a kind of training ground for like the real suffering, and that they're really, really actually quite helpful to us. But I feel like you asked something else that I missed there.
Well, the idea of are these the things that are making up, like that famous passage, right? That we can make up for what's lacking in Christ's suffering. Right. Like, what did Paul mean?
Yeah, it's a weird passage. It's just as weird as when Jesus tells us, you know, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Like, that's a really weird saying. We're supposed to carry the cross? I thought Jesus died for our sins. Why do I have to carry a cross? And I think what he's showing us in that passage and in the one from Colossians 1:24 is that the cross opens a door, right? Jesus definitively opens the door to salvation, to heaven, to life with God forever. And yet he invites us to be part of that process. And this is kind of weird, right? So like Jesus' sacrifice is totally sufficient to cover all of the sins of the whole world forever and ever. There's no deficiency in Christ's sacrifice. But what is deficient, right? My own participation in his sacrifice, right? My own acceptance of the cross, my own picking up of my cross and following after him. So the more that I do that, right, the more that my sufferings are sort of caught up into his and begin to participate in the redemption of the world. So Jesus actually gives us the opportunity through our sufferings, right, to participate with him in the redemption of the whole world. And this is a beautiful thing, right? This is an awesome opportunity, if you will, that he offers to us. And, I think a lot of us neglect it, right? I think a lot of us don't offer up our sufferings and we don't handle them in the right way. And we do complain a lot, you know, and that kind of thing. And the Lord is actually inviting us to, you know, allow our sufferings to be transformed and changed into this beautiful reality that changes and saves the world.
Yeah. One of my hardest, most powerful and life-giving Lent was giving up complaining for Lent 1 year, and how hard that was to do. Because you just have to take the, you know, you, I think my rule was I either have to actually fix it, so not just complain, but actually, you know, address that situation, not just complain about it, or just suffer through it, right? Yeah. And that was, gosh, that was hard as heck, but I mean, life-giving, and I mean, for a little bit, changed who I was. My wife would argue that not very long. I was changed from back to that the complaining quite quickly. But that, you know, that just offering that up, not just complaining about it, but, you know, offering those things up. There's a uniquely Catholic experience in suffering there. I mean, I was an evangelical convert to Catholicism. Many listeners to this show are in that boat or on that journey or have taken that journey. And I know many of us will say the same thing, right? That they're, you know, Christ is on a crucifix, on the cross in the Catholic Church for a reason that it's often just a bare cross in an evangelical church. There's a difference there. And I think one of those major differences is that the Catholic Church has a rich history of understanding suffering in a way that, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily understood as an evangelical. I would have suffered. I would have prayed about it. I would have felt like, possibly abandoned by God sometimes, or why am I suffering when I'm supposed to be like enjoying this life in Christ? Doesn't make a lot of sense. Becoming Catholic, right? There is such a rich tradition of understanding and embracing and offering up, and all these examples of the history of the saints are really understanding and just walking with God through suffering, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the balance between thinking about grace and suffering is really challenging. And I think for a lot of non-Catholics, the temptation is to think, well, we don't want anyone to try to earn their salvation through their suffering. So we're not going to regard it as important or redemptive or participatory whatever. Yeah. Because we don't want people to make the mistake of becoming works righteousness Christians or something. But I really feel like that is a kind of misguided objective. Because that's not what's happening when we suffer and offer it up as a spiritual sacrifice. We're not earning our salvation. We're actually like looking at the cross, looking at the crucifix and agreeing and saying, yes, Lord, I understand why you came to suffer for us. And I'm going to join you in that, right? I'm going to participate in that. I want to be part of that mission of suffering for the sake of the world. And it's not a way of earning my salvation, right? It's a way of participating in the grace of the cross. And that the Lord actually gives us the grace to do that, right? He gives us what we need to be able to make that offering and to make it sincerely. I just watched The Song of Bernadette. I don't know if you've ever seen it, right? About Saint Bernadette and the apparitions of Our Lady of Lourdes. And at the end of the movie, I think it's the most poignant scene. There's this sister that she's known since she was a little girl, who comes in and tells her, you know, like, I don't understand why you got these cool visions and I didn't, right? And I've suffered so much for so long and God didn't choose me, you know? And it's such a poignant scene where you're like, wow, I did not expect that. But clearly she had the wrong attitude. She didn't understand the combination of suffering and grace, right? Where God does break through and give gifts to his children, right? He does break through and offer us salvation that we didn't earn or expect or whatever, right? It really does come to us as a gift. And we need to be able to receive that gift with joy and gratitude and open arms and fidelity. But we also realize that suffering is part of the journey, but we don't really earn anything through our suffering, right? We just become closer to the Lord. That's what we want anyway, right? We long for him and we grow closer to him through the midst of our sufferings. And that's what it's about, right? Is growing closer to Jesus even in the tough times of life, and actually experiencing joy in the midst of it the whole way.
Yeah, yeah, that's fantastic. Well said. Dr. Mark Yuzcheck, fantastic conversation. Thank you for being here. I'll put links to this book, your other fantastic books also, in the notes for this show, in the description on the YouTube video. Anywhere in particular you want to point people towards to find, follow you? Where do you want to send them towards?
They can go check out my blog, catholicbiblestudent.com. I post all of my things there.
Yes, yeah. Fantastic. Awesome. I'll put links to that as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I want to say God bless you and the fantastic work you are doing for the church. And thanks for being here again. And take care.
All right. Take care.
Well, that wraps up another week of The Cordial Catholic. Thank you for listening, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed that conversation. Suffering is a weird, difficult topic, obviously, but I love those kind of rich conversations about hard topics like that. Hopefully you enjoyed that too. Let me know. CordialCatholic@gmail.com is our email address for your feedback. I'll be honest, guys, I'm currently inundated with emails. I have many, many piling up, which is kind of unusual and discomforting for me, but I will get to all of those as soon as I can. So thank you for your patience. If you've written into me, I'll get back to you, I promise, as soon as I can. CordialCatholic@gmail.com. Keep them coming, guys. It's fantastic. TheCordialCatholic.com is our website for show notes for my blog and those kinds of things. Please find us there. And please do find and follow us on Twitter or TikTok or Instagram @CordialCatholic. We're The Cordial Catholic on Facebook. And to watch what you're hearing, it's youtube.com/TheCordialCatholic. If you wouldn't mind just heading over there and subscribing to our channel, it is growing week by week, which is fantastic because more people get to see these videos. The algorithm kind of sees that you've liked it and subscribed and begins to widen the reach of these kind of conversations. And I think, maybe I'm a little bit biased, that these are the important conversations that people need to hear. If you think that too, head over to youtube.com/thecordialcatholic and subscribe to our channel. Like those videos to help that thing to keep on going and growing. You can support this show financially if you want to. Those links are in the show notes to Patreon and to PayPal. Thanks to those who are already faithfully part of that ministry. And guys, thank you for listening. I this is an absolute blessing to do this thing. Amazing journey. And thanks for being here with me. God bless, guys. Take care. Talk to you again next week. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.